Please be seated. It takes a little bit of imagination, but Hollywood has nothing on the reading from Genesis this morning. Stirring night visions, severed animal flesh of various species, fire and smoke passing between the divided parts, terrifying darkness and the promise of a little sex. Maybe I should be watching fewer movies. But we need some context to make sense of the scene that's drawn so dramatically here. Several years before today's action, Abram moved with his extended family from Ur in Mesopotamia. A dutiful Middle Eastern firstborn son, Abram packed up without comment, never questioning that his father was in charge of his life, though Abram was at that point married and no longer young. When he was 75 years old, his company had gotten as far as the city of Haran, and his father died. And that event, like every death, gave Abram an opportunity he had never dreamed of. "Go," a voice inside him said. "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation." It must be the Lord, Abram thought, though striking out on his own at this point seemed both scandalous and scary. Who would he be without his accustomed sense of himself, without his family, without his stuff? What would they do without him? And where was he headed anyway? The stirring voice didn't offer any easy answers, just a kick in the pants and hope. The voice didn't offer a roadmap or comfort, but it did give Abram a future that he didn't know he had. "Go," it said, "and you will be who you will be one day." And in that act of severing, of cutting ties with an old way of thinking, of shedding some clothes that no longer fit, of setting out for an unknown wilderness, Abram came to. And he took his first wakeful step toward finding himself and his true home. Now, waking up to who you are, as an adult child, or a member of a privileged race, or a resident of a struggling city, or an abuser of a substance, or part of a challenging relationship that needs to change. Waking up to who you are and choosing to lean into the truth instead of fleeing from it. Well, that's an act of faith, though not as we might ordinarily understand it. Faith is not blind obedience to an old order that no longer serves a healing purpose. Faith is seeing what's possible through unfamiliar eyes. Faith is not denying a difficult critique or diagnosis. Faith is embracing loss, admitting mistakes, accepting gifts as well as shortcomings so that something new and more life-giving might be born. Faith is not crossing your fingers and saying everything will work out. Faith is believing that God can only love and heal and build the beloved community with us and through us. Faith looks fear in the face and says, "I am, I can, I will, with God's help." And that's the promised land toward which Abraham goes. Now, Abram journeyed by stages into the Negev, which is the desert of southern Israel. And over the years, his flocks and herds and tents grew large. He and his wife Sarai became rich. And as his wealth increased, Abram's animals grazed on ever-widening circles of land. As often happens, the people in the surrounding countryside were at first impressed with Abram's success. But in time, that gave way to jealousy, and they began to feel crowded out. And finally, the neighboring people felt threatened by him and by what he had. And through it all, Abram and Sarai still had no child of their own. So in the midst of all that blessing, the one most longed for eluded them. Have you ever found yourself so stuck on what you don't have that you could hardly see what you did have? In today's reading, Abram has just returned from the battlefield, which is really no surprise if we think about it. Jealousy and a sense of limited resources has led to violence. Remember, I said that Abram's wealth had begun to crowd out everybody else. He hadn't thought about the implications of what he had, and that perhaps by living in such a way that others didn't suffer for his wealth, that perhaps things might go differently. But rather, they felt crowded out by what he had, and a band of local chieftains began breaking out in civil war over authority and property rights, and Abram's family was right in the middle of it. On one side, Lot, the son of Abram's brother, was taken, and everything he owned. When a fugitive from the skirmish brought Abram the bad news that his nephew was being held captive, Abram led forth his own trained army, 318 strong, and they overpowered the enemy, they used to be his neighbors, and brought Lot back to safety, but that experience rattled Abram. He realized that his wealth had had an impact on others. He realized how he dealt with his success had contributed to violence, even though he hadn't intended for it to have that effect. How could I have been so blind, he thought. Like every soldier, Abram came back from war a changed man. He'd never endured the madness or cold cruelty of battle. He'd never killed, never sensed his own death so close at hand. What if he had died, still childless, he wondered. So much for being the father of a great nation. I am an old fool, he must have thought to himself. And sometime later that evening, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Fear not, Abram. I am your shield, and your reward will be great. And Abram said, oh, Lord God, what can you give me, seeing that I shall die childless, and that the one in charge of my house is Eliezer of Damascus? Behold, since you have granted me no offspring, a slave will be my heir. And the word of the Lord came back to him in reply, this one shall not be your heir. None but he who comes from your own body shall be your heir. Well, Abram gazed down at his withered legs, his knees and ankles bony with age, and he chuckled to himself ruefully. Were there yet seeds of life in these limbs, dry and old as a tree? So God brought him outside and said, look up toward the heaven and count the stars if you're able to count them. So shall your seed be, which is the Hebrew word translated here as descendants. You see, it turns out that Abram's wilderness, like ours is usually, is less about the landscape he was in, and it's more about his facing vulnerability and self-doubt and fear. You can just hear him say, there is no way, just as we might say about something in our own families or about our own bodies or in our spirit or at work or at school or in Baltimore. There's no way. Healing that is impossible, we might say. But Abram discovers here that God has a way where there is no way. Right where Abram feels most exposed and without his accustomed props, the Lord tells him, don't worry about your seed. Your potency, your power, your potential, your possibility is as big as the sky. It's as countless as the stars, and it's as vast as the night that threatens to overwhelm you, the Lord tells him. and us. Don't worry about your potency, about your power, about your potential, about your possibility. You've got it, and it's bigger than you can imagine, he says. Well, not surprisingly, Abram asked, but how do I know that I can trust you? And that's our question, too, in the darkest part of our wilderness. So God says, bring me a heifer, 3 years old, and a 3-year-old she-goat, and a 3-year-old ram, and a turtle dove, and a young bird. And he has Abram cut them into pieces, into two parts, and to place each half opposite the other. And he stands over that sacrifice. And here's the part that's fit for Steven Spielberg or Stanley Kubrick. As the sun was about to set, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and a great dark terror descended upon him. And though he slept, Abram could still hear the Lord confide in him about his future. Again, no surprises. God says, your offspring will be many, but they will be strangers in a land not theirs. God says, and I will be with them, and I'll judge the good and the bad. And they will wander for 400 years, which in the Hebrew idiom is to say that they will wander forever. Home won't be where you expect to find it, God says. And I can just hear Abram say, I said yes to this. This is good news. And at this point, Abram tried to rouse himself, but he staked like a tent to the spot where he lay between the severed animal halves, and the dread is still heavy on his heart. When the sun had gone down, there appeared in the thick darkness a smoking furnace, a burning torch, an image of God, which passed between those pieces. And you see, they come out like this. They're on either side of Abram, and he's kind of in the middle of those severed pieces. It's light of the burning torch. It covered everything, and Abram's soul was filled with that light and with the smell of searing flesh, and he could feel the fearsome heat of the torch firing through his loins. And Abram awoke to himself. Abram awoke to the fact that God is connected to his potency. He awoke to the fact that God is calling him to take risks, and it's drawing him to his future. And Abram says, I can start over again. I can be a father, though it may not be as I expected. I can make changes in the middle of my life or late in the day. I can admit my fears and marshal the courage to move through them. Who am I? I'm God's child, and I'm as able as anyone to create the future that God has in mind. And I can find the promised land and author the promised people because I carry all of that potential within me, inside. Each of us does. Now, in the ancient ritual of the pieces, it's God that makes the promise, not Abram. I'm yours, God says to Abram in that vision. You can trust me. No matter how lost or unsettled you may be, I am your promise, God says. And if I ever abandon you, may I be cut into pieces like those animals. That's what is made manifest in that ritual. You see, fear doesn't mean that there won't be obstacles along the way. We know that. We worship God, writes Harold Kushner, not because he'll make our paths smooth, but because he gives us the grace and determination to keep walking, even when the path is rocky. And the wilderness is never quite what we expect it to be, and it's less the place itself, and it's more what happens to us in it. For Abram, the wilderness is struggling to believe that he can begin again. So can you. All of us can. I don't know if you've seen it this morning, but I commend to you the article written by our neighbor, Alec McGillis, in today's New York Times Magazine. Read it if you haven't already. It's titled, The Tragedy of Baltimore. the tragedy of Baltimore. But the only tragedy in Baltimore, I would argue, is if we disengage, if we pull back and stop believing that we've got the possibility that God has put in us. If we step back from the scary relationships that we're being called to have all the time and say, no, it's too much, it's too big, I can't do it, that would be the tragedy of Baltimore. If we stop making new and deeper relationships between neighbors and across races and classes, that would be a tragedy. If we go back to sleep and stop facing how the wealth of one tribe or people or individual can affect the life of others, we know that. That doesn't mean that wealth is bad. It means it has an impact. And it can be used for good. The only tragedy would be if we unplugged the organ and hung up our choir robes and told ourselves that giving praise to God or being made whole here or listening for God's voice or following God's radical, disruptive, compassionate way no longer matters. That would be the tragedy. No, there's no tragedy of Baltimore. Not if we'll measure our commitment to each other by God's commitment to us. You see, God is making a way where there is no way, inviting us to go into the promised land of restored community right here so that it can have an impact across time and across town, just like it did with old Abraham. Who says you can't teach an old dog new tricks? Because wherever it seems that it's impossible, God is saying, go, and together we'll make a way. Amen.